Welcome to Heart Yoga Radio. This is the third in our series on the body, and in this episode we are going to discuss ancient dualism, Cartesian dualism, and philosophical responses to them.
Yes. Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, well, we've already mentioned ancient dualism and Cartesian dualism in the previous episode, but in passing, without really explaining what we're going on about. So,
start off with ancient dualism.
Yeah, ancient dualism. Well, this is what Nietzsche called the soul hypothesis, or the soul superstition.
Yeah.
We don't think it's rather... He's a master of the put-down phrase, isn't he? Soul, the soul superstition.
Yeah.
And we've already mentioned the Bhagavad Gita and some of the ways in which that is interpreted, the central image of the chariot and the charioteer and the warrior in the chariot and the horses as a metaphor for the human being. As though the human being was consisted of parts, fairly discrete parts, and that the body, the human body, is somehow a container for something of greater worth and also of a different ontological character, something that perhaps is immortal. You know, the soul which is reborn, the Atman which is reborn, on that theory, is an immortal entity that lives inside a mortal and temporary entity made out of matter, and that the soul is somehow immaterial and the body is somehow material and clayey and dense. And Christianity's got the same stuff, you know, and presumably certain articulations of Islam, or else what is it that goes to heaven to enjoy the virgins? You know, what part of a martyr, a holy martyr, is it that's able to do that? So the essence of the ancient soul superstition is that there's an entity quite separate from the body that lives inside the body, that is responsible for consciousness, responsible for moral agency, responsible for agency, that is somehow the receiver of perceptions, somehow the ultimate doer of deeds, and so forth. That is just actually utterly, utterly distinct and separate from the body, and the body is merely a vehicle. And as I mentioned, this is a value system. You know, the soul is of a much higher value because it's immortal than the body, which is a piece of clay that goes back into the dirt. So that's ancient dualism. This received a fresh articulation by one René Descartes in the West, in France, who's actually, you know, a Frenchman. And Descartes elaborated what we call Cartesian dualism, which is the idea that there's really just two types of thing in the universe. And the one type of thing is called an extended thing, res extensa, which means simply extended thing. In other words, a thing that's a material object that has a position in space and time. Like the human body, like an atom, like that pebble, it has a position in space and time, and a weight, and a, you know, it's matter. So anything that you could measure in terms of position and locate on in a framework in space and time was an extended thing, a res extensa. But the human body is one of them. The other type of thing in the universe is a res cogitans, a thinking thing, and that this is entirely distinct from an extended thing, but somehow it lives in the body. Yeah?
Yeah,
a thinking thing lives in the body, but it's a totally separate entity. Hello, hello. And that this had no point of location, particularly in space and time. It's immaterial. was immaterial. Now this created a problem for Descartes and his critics, and the people who he spoke to in his lifetime came up with various objections to this idea. And one of the most difficult objections to it is that you have to explain how the thinking thing can make the extended thing, the body, can make it move. What is the point of connection? How can an immaterial something make a material something move? Because all movement, all dynamism is to do with extended things, actual material objects colliding with other material objects and so forth.
Yeah.
So here is this kind of ghost, this insubstantial ghost, going to make the body move? And Descartes kind of admitted, he said, it's a mystery, I don't know. And people came up with various ingenious answers, some of which would make you laugh.
Yeah.
I mean, I think at some point Descartes thought that the pineal gland had some kind of mediating role between the mind and the body.
What's the funniest one?
This thing called occasionalism.
Yeah.
I think that's Marlbranch or somebody, I don't know. I'm not sure, it might be somebody else. Occasionalism.
Yeah.
And the idea is that the mind and the body don't interact. It's not possible for them to interact, and they don't.
Oh.
But what happens is that each one is rather like a clock. So if you wind a clock up, remember these guys, everything's in terms of clockwork, you know?
Right, yeah.
Because that was their technology.
Yeah.
Just like we think of human beings as being like computers.
Yeah.
And talk about our downloading and RAM and ROM of our brains and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
These guys did exactly the same thing and used their most advanced technology as a metaphor for the human being.
Yeah.
And for them, it's clocks, you know. So your body's actually basically like a clock, and your mind's basically like a clock. And the two of them are wound up simultaneously and set going exactly simultaneously. And they've both got the same program. It's just basically to turn the hands. And that they both run together, in sync.
Yeah.
And that's what makes you feel as though you are doing something. But really you're not. It's just that the clock which is governing your mind is exactly synchronised to the clock which is running your body.
Right.
So it feels as though one does something. It feels as though the mind interacts with the body to make actions occur.
Right.
But really they've got these two kind of parallel series of identical events, or correlated events, happening in sync. And God, you know, who's going to put all this together? Oh, God. And you can see a lot of where Leibniz ended up in that idea. Anyway, that's another diversion.
Yeah, that's interesting though.
Yeah, so that was his excuse. But how did Descartes arrive at this? You know, through the famous meditations, it was called the cogito. And at some point, Descartes decided to figure out. What actually he could safely believe. And he thought, well, if I doubt everything that I can and throw out anything that it's at all possible to doubt, I should then, if I end up with anything, that'll be the thing that I can believe.
Yeah.
And I can start from that and then work outwards and build myself a system on that foundation. Mm-hmm. So it's like radical doubt of everything.
Yeah.
And he did a thought experiment. And imagine that an evil demon had just decided, for the hell of it, just to torture him, just to deceive him on every possible instance. Yeah?
Yeah.
And he thought, well, he could doubt the existence of the body, he could doubt the existence of all the things of waking consciousness, that tree, you, that boat. I can doubt that on a Cartesian, using a Cartesian radical doubt, because I might be dreaming.
Uh-huh.
Or I am deceived by an evil demon.
How did he end up with anything with that
How did he end up with anything? Well, he kind of locked himself in an oven somewhere or something like that.
Not a logical move.
He was sleeping on the top of a stove, you know, he lay on the top of a stove so he could kind of just get right inside himself. It is actually a meditation, you know.
Yeah.
And it's called meditation, it's the thing.
Yeah, yeah.
This particular story. But he said that he came to the point that the only thing, he could doubt the body, he could doubt his own body, he could doubt the content of his thoughts, he could doubt the contents of his perceptions, but he couldn't doubt that he was a thinking thing. And this is what he said. He said, we all know it, you know, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. This was the solid proof of his own existence. It was because even doubting is a species of thinking.
That's
the one thing that doubting can't undermine.
Yeah.
Is the cogito, I think, therefore I am, because doubting is a species of thinking.
Yeah,
but even in doubting, he asserts his identity. Yeah? And that was his starting point. He would build outwards from that.
Yeah.
And of course, well, it's quite beguiling. And it's thought to be, by many philosophers, you know, the foundation of modern philosophy. You need to remember that Descartes' thought took place in a context of the beginnings of rebellion against the church's dominance of the life of the mind. I mean, this is in exactly the same era that Galileo was put under house arrest for asserting the sun is at the centre of the universe, in contradiction of Aristotle, who was the church's philosopher. And they showed him the torture implements in the cellar at the Vatican. The Inquisition took him in, you know. They put the frighteners on him, then he retracted. But of course, Galileo was doing all this experimental physics, you know. But it wasn't safe for him to do it. It was like preaching free market capitalism in East Germany in 1980. You know, the Stasi's there knocking the door, man. But in the previous generation, or not so very long prior to that, a few people kind of were actually killed by the Inquisition or by the church for having the audacity to contradict the church's story.
Yeah.
Descartes was a mathematician. And he wanted to make the world safe for theoretical physics, for the kind of physics which uses measurement, for mathematical physics. And remember, you know, res extensa. The thing about it which was significant for Descartes is that it can be located in a system of mapping in space and time. We know where it is. We know where it is relative to another object. And that is the absolute basis of the kind of mathematical physics that Galileo was wanting to do, and it was an advance on it as well, because it held out the prospect of mathematically describing the physical world and making predictions on the basis of that. And Descartes, in fact, did, you know. And one of the first uses of this is ballistics, how to make sure that your cannonball inflicts the most damage. So just remembering the context there. And Descartes was in dialogue with various Jesuits, you know, and he kept it all low key. Because he didn't want to be dragged out and subjected to the thumbscrews. So he was looking for a way around that the mathematical physics could carry on and would have a future. And this is the kind of, you know, the political driver of his project. Okay, so he'd reached this point. That was a slight digression, but it'll become relevant in a minute. He reached the point of concluding, I think, therefore I am. So how is he now going to get out? You know, he's doubted the body, he's doubted the world, the existence of the world and the objects in the world. He even doubted the content of his own thought, except this one thought, which is the thought that asserts itself even if you doubt, However radical your scepticism, that thought will still assert itself. At least how it seemed, you know, perhaps it no longer seems like that, but certainly he was sticking to his guns on that one. So in a sense there's this kind of like little lonely point instant of consciousness, the I am, the cogito, attempting to recreate the world. You know, or attempting to find a way out of its solipsism, its complete imprisonment within itself, back into the world. Otherwise, what is the future of mathematical physics unless it can get out? Do you see it?
Yeah.
It's kind of stuck in the oven.
It's stuck in the oven.
And he's got to get out. And what he said was, well, if God is good, God would not deceive me about the nature of the world. And if I apply reason properly, i.e. in the morally correct fashion, with honesty, it introduces ethics into cold rationality, you know. There's proper reason and improper reason, and proper reason is virtuous and improper reason is kind of sinful. But I suppose this is all built into Christianity anyway, with the commandment, do not bear false witness. We're commanded to be truthful, you know. So it's got that on his side. Anyway, what he's doing there is he's saying, well, God would not deceive me. If God is good, God would not deceive me. So the world must exist. And my conclusions about the world, if I reason honestly and truthfully and therefore virtuously, I can arrive at truths about the world. Yeah, because of God. So he then goes on to give two or three proofs, so-called, of the existence of God. And he rehearses the time-honoured one, you know, the ontological argument and the cosmological argument. He kind of gives little brief accounts of those to say, well, God must exist, therefore I am not deceived when I reason properly. And in that way he was able to get out to the world again, you know, from the lonely solipsism of the cogito.
Yeah.
He was able to come to the world and regard it as a real world. But he couldn't do it without God.
Yeah.
He couldn't do it without... Which is highly convenient for him, since he was defending his whole project against the Jesuits. Because he saw the possibilities of mathematical physics, the technological possibilities, as well as the, you know, the cognitive revelations that would he hoped come about. He saw all that potentiality. You saw it. And of course, it is, you know, as a mathematician, this is the guy who developed the coordinate geometry, which is still called Cartesian geometry.
Morning.
Which is a method of mapping position in time and space on a grid, you know, on a graph, on a square grid. That's Cartesian geometry, and he worked out all the maths of that. Which, you know, it's the first move in mathematical physics. He didn't have all that much to say about experimentation, which of course was the other ingredient, even though he did himself do some experiments, some empirical stuff. And of course Galileo was really Mr. Experiment, you know. So it's not like he was unaware of that, but his concern was to develop this maths.
Yeah.
Which enables us to calculate future configurations of matter mathematically. Clever stuff. But of course for that he needed the concept of the res extensa, which he set into place with his through his meditation, she arrives at these two types of thing, and in which God plays a role. And this Cartesian geometry was like taken up by Leibniz and Isaac Newton, and they were able to build on that and develop the calculus,
yeah.
The differential and calculus. This game is like a fantastic mathematical tool that enabled loads and loads of physics to be developed. So, you know, it's he's a big figure, Descartes. He really is a big figure.
Yeah.
And it's great, you can read the meditations, you know, it's very short. And he writes in a kind of avuncular style. He's like the uncle telling you the story in the armchair, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like this impenetrable philosophical prose. It's down home. And you and you can follow it.
Yeah.
Anyway, that dualism, because it's a re-articulation of an ancient theme, as we've said, you know, worldwide people have believed some kind of body-soul dualism or body-mind dualism all over the planet. There haven't been very many monists who think there is only one type of thing going on,
yeah.
You know. Advaita notwithstanding, to be honest with you, it keeps the actual reality of Advaita is it does lapse back into dualism very often. Anyway, that's another question, of course. So yeah, because this dualism came in at this founding moment of modern Western philosophy, it's also one of the founding moments of modern science. It was bound to take on an immense cultural weight, which it still does. But it still does, you know. And I would say it's practically pernicious for reasons that I've mentioned before, you know. And this Nietzsche was a great critic of Cartesian dualism, simply because of the value system that got kind of brought along with it, you know. The contempt for the body. It tends to go along with these systems because one half of a dualism always gets valued more than another. Oh dear, we had a little bit of a tech glitch at that point and lost a small portion of the talk. I'm just about to make it good. Indoors, which will account for the difference in the ambience. Anyway, as well as objecting to Cartesian dualism on the terrain of values, Nietzsche also objects to the notion that the cogito is somehow final, that this is the one thing we can't doubt. I think, therefore I am. Nietzsche claims that Descartes is overlooking the fact that I think, therefore I am, is a linguistic statement and is dependent for its structure on the subject-predicate structure of the type of language that Descartes is using. Like, well, of course, Descartes wrote in French and Latin, you know, both Indo-European subject-predicate languages. And Nietzsche would say that the legitimate conclusion is not I think, therefore I am, but the statement should be there is thinking, and that is all he can legitimately claim. The I am bit is really an efflorescence of language rather than something to do with reality itself. It's interesting that an argument pretty much like this was repeated by Bertrand Russell much later in the 1940s in the History of Western Philosophy in the section on Descartes. You'll see pretty well this Nietzschean argument laid out by Russell. Interesting, because Russell was a very severe critic of Nietzsche. But there you go. Anyway, so back to the walk now. I mean, there is an objection to the objection that the cogito isn't an argument, which, you know, basically Nietzsche and Russell are saying that the cogito isn't an argument, and Descartes is presenting it as an argument, but it's a kind of a linguistic efflorescence or something like that.
Uh-huh.
The counter argument to that is to say, well, Descartes wasn't even doing that. It wasn't an argument, you know. And he probably knew, and that what in fact he was doing was founding a discursivity. In other words, he was looking at the off-the-peg framework that everybody was using, finding that it was acting as a kind of an inhibitor on inquiry and the development of mathematical physics to which he was committed, and that therefore needed to be kind of pushed out the way. Mindful of the Inquisition, ready to kind of chop his nuts off,
yeah.
He had to do this in a kind of a diplomatic kind of a way, you know,
yeah.
And in a sane sounding way. And in order to create the conditions for mathematical physics to thrive. Hello. And the whole cogito thing is that it's the founder discursivity, which has got two parts to it. You know, one the clearing away of that which is no longer helping, conceptually and culturally, and to replace it with a new paradigm, which would enable some new things to happen in human culture and human activity. And that's, you can say that is what he was doing. But of course, you know, I'm wanting to tackle it on the level of its practical import. You know, the fact that it's practically pernicious, that it plays into life negating body hatred and so forth. You know, and into splitting the human being in their own self image. Yeah. And this is something, as well as Nietzsche having a good old crack at this in many places, also, you find Wittgenstein tackling the same thing, you know, wanting to do the same thing, you know, of remove an old discursivity, an old way of talking that's no longer useful to us, that's getting us to buy into stuff that's not helping us to thrive. And to replace it with a different approach, you know, and one in which the human being isn't split. And Wittgenstein's way of tackling this isn't—he doesn't meet it head on. He just kind of deconstructs it through the analysis of our language, but also through criticisms of certain aspects of culture and behaviour. You know, and there's again another prominent and perspicuous philosopher who's wanting to push Cartesian dualism out of the way now. Well, I think for now that's probably what I want to say about that, but there's a lot of these themes that will just recur. We're still doing a kind of groundwork, really.
We'll be revisiting quite a lot of this in later episodes.
Talked about embodiment of thought.
Yeah.
Had a look at these philosophical and theological articulations. But there's a lot of themes in there that I think we'll kind of have to return to, or will crop up.
Yeah.
As we carry on. And I'm sort of quite pleased that that's in place early on.
Yeah, so we can got a nice foundation for the next episode.
Yes.